Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Seems everyone needs a little space these days. Bigger cars, McMansions, and even demands for more open spaces, protected vistas. We all want it, but it's taken a toll, a serious toll on the wild creatures, who need it just as much as we do. Some serious folks are working together in our backyards, backcountry, and around the world to provide real living spaces. How do they do it? Find out when we return to the Wildside News.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Yes, and don't forget there is a prize waiting for the first person to call in who has discovered the secret word, the secret phrase. When you discover that, make sure that you're looking around on today's webpage at wildsidenews.com. Remember that it's a piece of art. That may be a clue. So click around and see what might happen. And also, if you're on that webpage, it's going to make you more aware of what we're talking about as we look into this segment. These are interesting times on planet Earth. As we speak, Condoleezza Rice is talking to the 911 Commission about the war in Iraq. Things can seem fairly uncertain, yet in many ways, many around the world are working together to create systems that may lead to a vision that we may find ways to cohabit peaceably and sensitively with other life on the planet. Certainly that can be said about our guest, David M. Johns, who is a leader in researching, organizing, monitoring, and developing systems and alliances which are creating international webs of interconnected life-supporting areas called corridors. These are critical to counter what some feel is a quickening of species extinctions as natural ranges and spaces are cut up into smaller and smaller isolated areas. David Johns has been working for the conservation of wildlife and wild places for two decades. He was co-founder and first executive director of the Wildlands Project and is an advisor to conservation groups in Russia, the Far East, Australia, and many other areas. He teaches politics and law at Portland State University. He joins us from his home in McMinnville, Oregon. And I want to welcome our callers who may have an interest to call in and ask questions of David at 888-327-0061. David, lay it out on the line. What's happened to our living creation here on Earth that you address in your work with the Wildlands Project?
Well, first of all, Sydney, I want to thank you for having me on the show. It's a great pleasure to be here. I think what I would first do is ask your listeners to think for a moment about what a map of North America would look like, a map of all the existing protected areas. I think two things would stand out on that map. The first thing that would stand out is that most protected areas are small, and even relatively large ones like Yellowstone are simply not big enough to perpetuate healthy populations of many of the larger animals like bison or grizzlies or wolves. And they need not just big space, but they also need safe space, space where they won't be shot, space where they won't be run over, space where they can avoid conflict with human beings. The other striking feature I think that your listeners would see on that map, which you've already alluded to, is that almost all of the protected areas are islands. They're isolated from each other, disconnected from each other by large areas of developed habitat. And what this means is that animals that need to move can't move. They need to disperse. The young need to find new ranges. Animals need to breed. There needs to be genetic flow. And many animals need to migrate seasonally as the weather changes. The Wildlands Project is working really throughout North America. That's our area of focus, to restore and protect all native species and to ensure that all ecosystem types are represented in protected areas in ways that, that they can be fully functional, large enough. So we take what the best science tells us to do and work with people, again, throughout North America, communities and other conservation groups, to first design and then implement systems of protected areas that are connected. Sometimes that means growing existing protected areas. Sometimes that means creating new ones. But especially what that means is trying to link them up and to overcome the fragmentation that exists so that animals can move again. And it's not just a terrestrial issue or phenomenon either. Dams block salmon from moving and so on.
Yes, you know, it sounds, it certainly makes perfect sense that, that you have all these isolated patches. And obviously animals need much greater range to be able to really survive. So what you're doing is connecting these in ways and protecting the corridor, what they're calling them corridors, and of course this is becoming quite an international cutting-edge policy. For example, you know, Conservation International is working on this. And I think actually you and the Wildlands Project were some of the early researchers into this, developing the concepts for this. Give us a brief history of sort of how this came about and how it's affecting wildlands today.
Yes, the development of the notion of connectivity really has sort of a long history, and it's interesting that both scientists and conservationists who were working on the ground really begin to notice in the 1980s that a lot of the protected areas were losing their wildlife, that something was wrong. And one of the things that was wrong is that quite often we had protected areas that were beautiful or areas that were high elevation where people liked to hike and to play. We hadn't really thought a lot about protecting things on the basis of biological diversity. And of course one of the problems there is that many other creatures like the same kinds of lands that human beings like to develop and live on, and so there's often a conflict. But scientists who had been studying islands for a long time noticed that islands were particularly prone to extinction. The smaller the island was, generally the fewer species it has or had, the easier it was for a disease or some other event to create problems that would damage biodiversity on that island. And again, in looking at maps of continents, these same scientists begin to see that our protected areas were becoming islands. When they were created, they weren't, but as development occurred over the years, the areas around Yellowstone have been logged, have been settled by small towns, and it's very difficult now, say, for animals to connect from Yellowstone to central Idaho or up to Glacier Waterton Parks and so on. So scientists and activists begin to look much more closely at this, and they begin to realize that evolution and biological functioning occurred on lots of different scales, including some very, very large scales, like the continental scale, like at the level of regions within a continent, such as the Yellowstone to Yukon or the Klamath-Siskiyou in Oregon or any number of other types of systems. So we realized that we had to address things at the level and at the scale at which they were breaking down. And it had really never been done that way before. So we invested quite heavily in the science. We were among our co-founders were some of the preeminent scientists involved in this kind of work, Reid Noss, Michael Soule, and others. And over the years, we were able to bring a large number of scientists together to work on these problems. One of the results of that was a book called Continental Conservation, which is edited by Michael Soule and John Terborg, which has had enormous influence around the world and with other conservation groups and scientists as well. Working at this scale, I should say, is extremely important, but it's not the only scale, of course, that we have to work at. And even when you look at the large scale, it always comes down to things in people's backyards, the local highway, the local development that can break up habitat. So even though we have to think big We have to act on lots of different levels as well. This is not just work for people operating at 30,000 feet. This is work for everyone.
You know, as I say, it makes perfect sense, and I'm sure almost every single one of our listeners gets this one. But I try to imagine how in the world you go about this. I mean, it's one thing to visualize this, and it's another thing to put it to actually make it happen. I was thinking about this, for example. You're working on the Yellowstone to Yukon project, as well as the Sky Islands Wildlands Network, which, by the way, is there's a map of that on the website on today's show, segment two. But, you know, if I imagine getting on the field and looking down and trying to say, okay, where is the range? What are the animal species here? What are the encumbrances? Where are the corridors? How in the world do you actually do that?
Well, we take a three-pronged approach. The first prong is to look at a range of species. We can't study everything. There's just too many critters out there. So what we tend to do is focus on animals that are wide-ranging, so for instance, antelope, caribou, elk, animals that move around quite a bit, salmon, if you're thinking of aquatic environments, move around quite a bit. And we look at species which require a lot of space, and these are usually the top predators, grizzly bears, mountain lions, wolves. They need lots of space. There are other species as well, bird species which move around a lot. There are some species that require very particular habitats. So we try to select a suite of species that we think have the greatest needs, if you will. And we look then and try to determine exactly what it is they do need, what sort of land, what sort of protection, what sort of management do each of these species need to survive into perpetuity. What does the best science tell us we need to do? And so we look at those, and by protecting those, we hope and we do know to some degree that when we protect some species who need large areas, we protect much else. The other path that we use to try to determine what to protect is to look at ecosystem functionality. How do watersheds work? How do hydrologic cycles work? Watersheds, those kinds of things. What do we need within the protected area to make sure all of those ecological processes continue to function? Other sort of track that we use in trying to design these areas is what we call special elements. There are some very rare features geographically, geologically, biologically, that we also try to include. Maybe a very rare swamp type or a patch of old growth, or again, something that's become all too rare that we really want to include in the system. We then look at what's already protected in the area, public lands, private lands. There are many organizations that are involved in buying private lands, or ranchers and others who've decided that they want to protect their land and are putting easements on it and so on. And then we try to look at what else we will need and develop a strategy and go to the community and try to build support for implementing that strategy. So there, in a very brief nutshell, is how we approach.
That was a brilliant summary there. By the way, I want to encourage listeners to go to the website, which is www.twp.org, to find out a lot more. And, of course, you'll also find about the Wild Earth Journal, which is a wonderful magazine that covers these issues and has some really in-depth, beautiful reporting about things that are going on. You're working on a number of different projects. One that I have, as I say, featured on the website for today's show is the Sky Islands Wildlands Network. That just sounds so beautiful. What is that?
Well, in southern Arizona, New Mexico, and parts of Sonora and Chihuahua, the terrain is a very mountainous terrain, but the mountains are not sort of continuously linked. It's almost like patches. It's a little like the Great Basin, the Basin and Range, but not exactly. So one has rising above the desert floor, these extraordinarily beautiful mountain ranges. And of course, any sort of mountain is, by virtue of the change in elevation, is usually going to have a wide variety of life forms, of ecosystems, and blendings of those systems together, and so on. Often very unique, very complex. And the Sky Islands essentially is the term that refers to these various patches of mountains throughout the Southwest. So that's what we take the name of the Wildlands Network from for that region. In fact, we're not just, of course, protecting or proposing to protect the mountains, but much of the intervening land. Changes in management are going to be important, not just protection. So, for instance, restoring the flows and rivers, removing exotic species, all of these are part and parcel of the process as well. So the Sky Islands actually includes the mountains as well as many, many lowland areas, and we've got many ranchers in the area cooperating with us, as well as local governments, and the highway departments are working on connectivity. So there's lots of good stuff happening.
We're kind of running out of time. Dave, what can people do to help you and your friends make this vision come true?
Well, a couple of things. I think the more people understand about the need for big protected areas and for connectivity, and then just get involved. Organize, get involved.
Dave, we're going to continue this conversation into the future and talk a lot more, and actually have some special shows about this. Dave, thanks so much for coming on our show.
Thank you very much.
This is Sidney Wildsmith. You're listening to the Wildside News Show, the worldwide leader in Internet talk.